You can easily get the sense that small family farms are a rarity in America now, replaced by mega farms owned by industrial outfits. The farms themselves are still largely owned by local farmers. Several sets of figures bear that out. But it is often pointed out that farmers get contracts with and instructions from the food industry dictating a lot of their practices. There is another way to farm, and we get examples from time to time. Today we'll hear about the efforts of some farmers in Montana to change their part of the world. The story is told in the book Lentil Underground, Renegade Farmers and the Future of Food in America. It is the work of Liz Carlisle, who's a journalist and doctoral fellow at the Center for Diversified Farming Systems at the University of California, Berkeley. She has been a lecturer at Cal and at Stanford and was a legislative aide to Montana Senator John Tester. Liz Carlisle, welcome to The Exchange.
Thanks so much, Jeffrey. My pleasure.
Very good to have you here. You're a Montana native. What did you know about the lentil farmers growing up there?
Gosh, you know, very little. My grandmother had grown up in western Nebraska on a farm, but I was raised in Missoula on the western side of the mountains there. So, you know, I knew a little bit about the livestock industry in our part of Montana, but very little about lentil farmers until, fate connected me with them.
Let's talk about that fate, because the book starts from a moment of disillusionment in your own life. What happened right after you got out of Harvard?
Yeah, well, you know, I went into country music because I really did want to hear from farmers about, I just always thought it was interesting when people would talk about their philosophy of working with the land and what it meant to do this really fundamental human work, I think, of creating food through a partnership with the natural environment. So I had kind of an idealistic notion about all of this and was traveling around as a country singer, and people did tell me these amazing stories about their land ethic and their agrarian traditions, but then their face would kind of fall and they'd say, you know, but we can't really do this because, just as you said, you know, the companies to whom we sell really are only willing to buy one crop, really only from one variety of seed, and these are the chemicals they tell us to use, and, you know, on and on and on, and we really feel more like factory workers. So, you know, even though we have these ideas about how we could take better care of our land and our communities, there are some big barriers.
So they're forced by economic realities, it sounds like, to do things the way that the people they're selling stuff to dictate.
Right, yeah. And then those economic realities, in turn, supported by policy. So that's when I went to work for Senator John Tester. I quit my job as a country singer because I'd heard there was this organic farmer from my home state of Montana who wanted to do things differently and had an idea about how we could do it, and even at the highest levels of government, and had unseated this three-term incumbent who was on the Appropriations Committee, as the school board member on the Soil Conservation District talking about organic farming and living local economies. So I went to work for him, and I quickly realized that he wasn't just one guy trying to buck the system, that he was the product of a rural social movement, underappreciated, really not known outside Montana. And so I got inspired to study with those farmers and ultimately now to tell their story.
Let's pause for a moment at that intermediate step, though, to go from country singer to D.C. office jockey. I can't imagine a more opposite tack.
It was a lifestyle change.
No doubt. What were some of the frustrations with the job in Senator Tester's office?
You know, the office itself was like this wonderful oasis of sanity and honesty.
Mm-hmm.
My coworkers there, you know, still are great friends and trusted mentors to me. But obviously in an environment in which there was a lot of cynicism about the way democracy was being done, you know, obviously a lot of influence of money in politics, sort of the double speak that people are used to if you hear, kind of the typical campaign speeches and that sort of thing. It was quite difficult to try to get things done. Not as difficult as I think it is now. We didn't have complete gridlock. And, what we did have was this incredibly engaged citizenry. And my job was to talk to them and then relay their thoughts to the policy team. So I got pretty fired up, you know, on the phone with people. You know, John's from a town of 300 people, you know, many people like this, mm-hmm. who understood their role as citizens as calling up their Senate office and saying, you know, this is what I think we should do in legislation.
Well, one of the things I was really struck by, it really provides an oh yeah moment early in the book, was the people on the phone telling you, thousands of miles away in Washington, that people in D.C. want quick fixes. And you stop and think, oh, that's right. Everything needs to kind of work within an election cycle. And we seem to be expanding the cycle and reducing the zone in which people can work now.
That's exactly right, yeah. And they were saying, you know, you're probably not going to be in this job long enough to realize the kind of things that we need to do to change this country. You know, the kind of long-term thinking that you might have on a farm that you intend to pass down to your grandchildren is seldom what you're going to find in an election cycle type of reality. And, you know, John was certainly doing his best, and I'm glad he's in a second term. I think he is able to do some longer-term work. But I was really inspired at that point, rather than trying to tackle a bunch of different issues at a relatively shallow depth, to really dig in and spend a few years with this particular group of farmers and this particular window on trying to shift our food system, our rural economy, you know, ultimately to some extent, hopefully, the economic engine of our society.
Correct my pronunciation if necessary, but you ended up at David Oyen's farm. Why him?
Yes. Well, you know, what people were telling me on the phone is I would say, you know, so tell me about how your farms are different. And they would say, well, you know, it used to be all we had was wheat out here, but that had to be supported with an awful lot of chemicals, and those were expensive and bad for the environment, and people are getting cancer. So we wanted to add in fertility in a different way that wouldn't require chemicals. And so we figured out that the way to do this was to plant a crop in the bean family, because any legume, any crop in the bean family can pull nitrogen out of the atmosphere and supply it to the root zone. So it's like growing your own fertilizer, literally. And in Montana, they're a little bit limited with this 100-day growing season, you know, only 14 to 18 inches of rain. So the only legume that was really working well for them was lentils, maybe chickpeas, maybe dry peas. But they found out about it from this guy, David Oyen.
All right, we'll talk more about David Oyen and your encounter with him and lentils and the growing of lentil underground, the name of the book by Liz Carlisle, subtitled Renegade Farmers and the Future of Food in America. We'll come back and talk more about Liz's experiences with the folks in Montana and what we can all learn from that ourselves as we return to the Jefferson Exchange with your phone calls and emails in a minute 15. Back on the Jefferson Exchange on the News and Information Service of Jefferson Public Radio. I'm Jeffrey Riley. Thank you for listening. Our guest today is Liz Carlisle, journalist and doctoral fellow at the Center for Diversified Farming Systems at UC Berkeley. She has investigated it's a long story, but it started with her being a country singer, led to her working in the D.C. office of Senator John Tester, and then talking to constituents back in Montana, where he's from. She ended up going out to investigate what was going on with lentil farmers in western Montana. You can join us on the Jefferson Exchange as we talk about her book, Lentil Underground, 800-838-3760 for your phone calls with questions, and your emails can go to jx@jeffnet.org. So David Oyen at the heart of all this, an interesting first meeting that you described with him. You say you sort of talked through each other. What do you mean that by that?
Well, you know, I think it took a little bit of time for us to kind of get to the heart of the matter. I was, you know, ostensibly I was a doctoral student doing dissertation research. I think I presented myself to him somewhat formally. And, you know, maybe the reverse was true as well. But within a couple of days of knowing each other, I think we realized that we were both on this path of trying to start with the place where we were, but work towards a very ambitious vision of a more sustainable world.
And so what finally broke the ice in that meeting with him the first time?
Well, you know, I tell the story of this interesting moment. I am from Missoula, Montana, and David is from Conrad, but he went to college in Missoula for a time, and he studied with a man who actually was involved in my parents meeting each other and getting together, this larger-than-life character named Joseph Brown, who was a scholar of American Indian spirituality and religion. And this was a really formative time in David's life, and he brought this up to me in our first conversation. He noticed that my license plates said that I was from Missoula, and he said, you know, do you know who Joseph Brown is? And so I think we connected there right away, because anybody who was associated with Joseph was thinking on a pretty deep level about how we could be in more harmony with Mother Earth. And he just had this circle of people around him who were quite compelling, original thinkers.
So David was not the kind of guy who had intended, it sounds like, to spend his whole life on Dad's farm and just take it over as his own at some point.
No, no. I think David's parents and David himself probably figured that when he left for college, he was leaving for good. But what he learned in college and, you know, getting involved in the environmental movement, getting involved in the anti-war movement, was that the land was a pretty good place to start if you wanted to change some of these social forces. And that if you did want to try to get out of the loop of the military-industrial complex, that, you know, growing your own food without chemicals was maybe a good path, actually, to setting society back on a saner pathway. So, yeah, he came home at age 27 and said, "Dad, I want to put solar panels on the roof. And by the way, I think this should be an organic farm."
That would be a bit of a change. And how did his father respond?
What?
Yeah.
You know, his father, he describes, is actually in some senses a little more open-minded than some of the other folks in the community, but just quite pragmatic financially. His questions were always, you know, how are you going to make this pencil out? And so he had a lot of work to do to prove to his father that this other way of doing things not only made sense for the environment and for society, but would allow him to earn a livelihood.
I want to underscore the sense of what the other farmers in that region were experiencing. We talked about the fact that it's a short growing season, not a lot of water, about 100 days, 12 to 14 inches of water. So some serious challenges that are going to limit your crop choices right out of the chute. But it sounds like because of the way that the whole industrial agriculture system and industrial food system is set up, a lot of the farmers really just felt like cogs in a machine.
That's right. Yeah. Yeah. It was tough to be a farmer anywhere in this country in the 80s, in particular, a time that was called the farm crisis. Three things happened at the same time. There were terrible drought years, three really tough droughts in the late 80s. The fertilizer prices were quite high because fertilizer is based on fossil fuel. So when global oil markets go sky high, fertilizer prices are high too. At the same time, global grain prices were quite low. Those are also affected by geopolitics. So farmers just felt just totally helpless in this situation, that they had these low prices for what they were producing, high prices for what they had to purchase to produce it, and on top of it all, they had all this drought. So this was a time when people either got out of agriculture or had to make some pretty big changes. And that was the window, you know, into which this Lentil Underground steps.
Now, as you point out, underground actually has two meanings. I mean, there's the movement sense of underground, but the plant itself, you gave us some taste of what legumes are capable of doing in terms of pulling nitrogen out of the air. So what are they doing underground to the soil?
Yeah, so they're pulling nitrogen out of the air, and then it's these bacteria that actually live in their roots that convert that atmospheric nitrogen into a form that's available to plants. So even though nitrogen makes up 78% of the atmosphere, most plants can't access it directly. But crops in the bean and pea family, legumes, they can. So it's this nitrogen factory underground happening in the roots, this symbiotic relationship between bacteria and the lentil roots, that's creating a fertilizer source that doesn't rely on an out-of-state corporation, doesn't rely on a chemical, is part of the farming system itself.
Liz Carlisle's our guest on the Jefferson Exchange. Her book is Lentil Underground. So obviously lots of good reasons to grow lentils, but I mean, it still sounds like heresy in that part of Montana for Dave to suggest to his dad to take the plunge.
Right. And, you know, there's some good reasons for that. The farm policy that we had at that time was that you would get a direct payment from the government for planting acreage of, you know, an acceptable staple crop. So you had these base acres enrolled that you were going to plant in barley, in this case, wheat for many other farmers in Montana, and you would get a check from the government no matter what happened, whether you got hailed out, if you didn't have a market. You had this stable baseline income that was coming in as long as you planted that crop. Now, if they took those acres out of barley, even just for 1 year, and planted lentils, they lose that. So they can't ever go back and get that base income payment again, you know. So it was sort of stepping off into this much riskier form of agriculture because the whole safety net for the agricultural system had been set up for these, you know, five core commodities.
So it really made it hard to wander off what you had been doing in a new direction.
It was just tremendously risky, yes.
So so what did Dave propose then? I mean, you said that his father said he had to make this all pencil out. So what were some of the things he suggested for a way to approach lentils?
Well, you know, we did it gradually. You know, it sort of started with 10% of the farm, 15% of the farm. You know, and then eventually generational change. You know, eventually Dave's father passed and he took over the farm, and then it was sort of his decision what kinds of risks he was willing to take. And he just felt like, you know, the biggest risks were the environmental risks and the health risks of continuing in the other system, and that there was no way the farm was going to last, you know, more than a generation along that path. And, you know, he banded together with other farmers who were willing to take this plunge as well. And even though they didn't at the beginning have the larger scale safety net of the U.S. government and the Farm Bill, they did sort of have the safety net of one another. You know, they had enough of a community that could support each other and pooling labor and pooling resources to develop infrastructure, that it wasn't like any one person was in this alone.
It's interesting to watch the ways that David Oyen was able to pull things together on his own farm first and then form alliances with other people along the way. You mentioned the fact that he tried to talk his dad into putting solar panels on the roof. He was successful there, right?
He was, yeah. He got his dad up on the roof with him, putting those solar panels up there. And he did it by convincing him it would pencil out. He did some calculations and says, you know, this is how much money we're going to save over time on our energy bill.
And it didn't stop at the farm, it sounds like. I mean, he went pretty far in preaching the solar gospel from the sounds of it.
Yeah. He got the whole community excited about it and even got the minister of the Presbyterian Church to put some on his own home.
This is also, again, somewhat heretical, I'm thinking, in that part of Montana.
I think it was a pretty dang new idea, yes. Mm-hmm. And you know, it also, you have to understand, too, that this is a guy who's been involved in the anti-war movement. He has long hair. You know, so this was part of a larger kind of cultural divide and counterculture movement. And what was interesting about Dave is I think, you know, he came back home pretty fiery, having been involved in these various movements in the late 60s and early 70s. And then those movements sort of melded for him with some of the older agrarian traditions from his father's and grandfather's generations, you know, about cooperative organizing and a land ethic. And so, you know, over time, I think he has come to be less of a sort of fiery renegade figure and more of this interesting sort of, there's more continuity there. He draws more threads back to earlier organizing traditions. And I think he's convinced a lot of people that organic agriculture is not a departure, but in fact is sort of a return to the path that these communities, you know, ought to be on anyway.
Liz Carlisle's our guest on the Jefferson Exchange, the author of Lentil Underground, Renegade Farmers and the Future of Food in America. We're talking about farmers who split off from the standard grain growing in her part of Montana, their part of Montana. She's a Montana native herself and ended up growing lentils instead. Join us on the Exchange. Questions, comments, thoughts about the way that the food industry is handled now and could be and has been. 800-838-3760 by phone, by email, jx@jeffnet.org. Here's Jeannie in Medford. Welcome to the Jefferson Exchange.
Hi, I love lentil soup. It's so healthy. Did Willie Nelson, is that what you were talking about in the 80s? Was that farm aid concept? Oh,
yes.
Good. So that's the era when you said everything went south in the 80s. I remember a benefit concert. I thought, Willie Nelson. Mm-hmm. Now, did that money help the farmers that they raised?
Thanks for the question.
You know, it did. And it still does. You know, Farm Aid continues as a really powerful voice for farmers who have been caught in this corporate industrial system and are not doing as well as a result. Willie Nelson, wonderful agrarian voice.
You bring up the term legume renegades to talk about David Oyen and the other farmers that he pulled together, but you also introduce a legume cowboy, Dr. James Sims at Montana State. What did he go out looking for? What was his purpose here?
Well, he was a public researcher who was at Montana State University and was the only person among his colleagues in the 80s who took organic farming seriously. You know, other folks at the land-grant universities, for the most part, really just didn't think this was a viable way to farm, a viable way to earn a living. They thought it was backwards. You know, the chemical approach was pretty deeply entrenched at that time. But James Sims actually went to Australia in the late 60s, and that's where he first learned about legumes being grown in rotation with grains. It was called the lay system over there. But, you know, he essentially brought that model back, that idea of that model, and it was a conversation between him and David Oyen and some of these other organic farmers in the 80s that led to this experiment, because parts of Australia are quite similar to Montana in climate. So it made sense that this might actually work for Montana farmers, too.
The experiments involved some things that you don't hear much about, or at least I hadn't heard much about. Black Medic, for example. Tell us about that experiment and their efforts to not only look for stuff they could plant, but also the process of planting.
Yeah. So what they were looking for was a legume that would fit into the grain rotation, that would be hardy in their environment. So they had this idea, why don't we just look around and see what's growing naturally? You know, literally, look at the side of the road. You know, look at the plants that people call weeds. What leguminous plants really like it here in Montana? And they saw this black medic. So this was a relative of many other medic plants, which were being used in this Australian lay system. And they were so excited when they realized, oh my gosh, it fixes all this nitrogen and it's self-reseeding. We can plant it under our grain crop and it'll just reseed itself and supply fertility. You know, they were all excited about this. But then, you know, the housewives in the community already knew this plant as a lawn weed. So they had a lot of territory to cover in terms of convincing people that planting a weed in their farms was a good idea.
So this is really akin to telling people, hey, we love dandelions. Let's get a lot of dandelions out here.
Exactly. That was what they were trying to do, and it was an uphill battle.
So talk about how Dave and three other guys began zeroing in on the idea for a company.
Yeah. Well, you know, they realized that they needed to grow a legume on their farms in order to be able to grow grain without chemicals, that they needed to put this in the rotation for the farm to be sustainable. The problem was there wasn't anybody in town who would buy any kind of leguminous crop. And, you know, they weren't in the consumer market at the time. They were typical commodity farmers who just took their grain to the elevator. So not having a market was a big problem. So they settled on this edible legume, lentils, that they could sell as a food crop. And then, you know, it started with just four guys getting together in the outbuildings of David's farm and literally putting these lentils in 25-pound brown bags and going around to some natural food stores to see if they would buy them.
And how'd that go?
It was pretty slow going at first. You know, not a lot of Montanans eating lentils in the 80s. So pretty quickly they realized they were going to need to start looking outside Montana for a market. You know, also not a very large population in Montana overall. So they go to California. They go to a trade show in the early 90s, and they find their first buyer. And so all of a sudden they have to ramp up and produce, you know, 400,000 pounds of these things. So that's how they're able to rope in six other farmers and lease an old grain elevator and, you know, start to get serious about the infrastructure to process and clean to food grade and really start to develop some markets.
Give us an idea of 400,000 pounds of finished lentils and what are we talking about in terms of acres and farms involved?
Yeah, well, you know, this is the production off of 6 to 8 farms. Mm-hmm. And it wasn't the only crop they were growing because they were growing it in rotation. You know, but that's how many people were involved at that time. And now they've expanded to the point where this company markets the legume rotation for about 20 to 25 family farms. And those farms range in scale from about 1,000 acres to about 9,000 acres.
All right. So a lot of acreage and lentils in that part of Montana.
Yeah, so pretty heartening.
You bring up in the book Dave Oyen and Jim Barngrover, one of the other partners, working at the state capitol. What kinds of obstacles to organic farming were present in Montana state law when they were working it?
One really big problem was actually just a legalized labeling system for organic. You know, in the early days, this wasn't a USDA policy, which, of course, we now have. This was just individual certifiers, and there was a lot of legal uncertainty in many states about you know, what those standards were and what it would take to legally label your food as organic. So this group of people was involved in the legislation that created those labeling standards and eventually an organic certification program that's actually run by the state of Montana. In addition, they really lobbied to have public research that would apply to their systems because there were all these scientists at Montana State University whose mandate was to serve farmers, but all they knew about were the chemically based systems. So they actually carried a bill that was passed in the early 90s that funded and required Montana State University to hire a weed ecologist. You know, and that might not sound like the most exciting piece of legislation you could imagine right there, but, you know, somebody who knew about biological systems and not just about chemically based agriculture.
I'm curious enough if the terminology has changed over time, because obviously one person's weed is another person's cash crop.
Right. Yes. Weeds is all a matter of perspective.
All right. Much more to talk about Liz Carlisle. Her book is Lentil Underground, Renegade Farmers and the Future of Food in America, Following Lentil Farmers in Montana, her native state. Welcome back to the Jefferson Exchange and talk more with Liz and take phone calls and emails from you if you'd like to join the conversation. Back on the Jefferson Exchange in a minute 20. Final segment on today's Jefferson Exchange. I'm Jeffrey Riley. Thank you for listening. Our guest today is Liz Carlisle, doctoral fellow at the Center for Diversified Farming Systems at the University of California, Berkeley, and a journalist and a country music singer and a former worker in the office, District of Columbia office of U.S. Senator John Tester from Montana. That's where Liz is from, and it is where the events take place in her book, Lentil Underground, Renegade Farmers and the Future of Food in America. You can join us on the Jefferson Exchange as we talk about pushing the food system in a way that perhaps involves a less chemically dependent form of agriculture. 800-838-3760 for your phone calls. Your emails go to jx@jeffnet.org. I saw you described as a protege of Michael Pollan, the Omnivore's Dilemma author, at some point. Have you spent much time working with Michael?
Yeah, he's just been a terrific mentor for me. I think for many people in terms of just our thinking about food, and then for me also as a writer. Something many people don't know about Michael is what an incredible and dedicated teacher he is. He teaches in the Department of Journalism at University of California, Berkeley, and I was lucky enough to be in his writing workshop and then to be mentored by him throughout the process of writing my first book, which was quite a journey.
No doubt. A journey in a couple of senses, though. One of them is just realizing the work that he did with Omnivore's Dilemma, which is 20, 25 years old now? Is it that old?
You know, I want to say 2004 or
2006. Okay, so more recent than that. Okay, all right. So
yeah.
Just 10 years old, but or 10 or 12. But the point being that describing things that began a while ago and still seem like they're having a little trouble getting a toehold as people try to do more sustainable forms of agriculture.
Yeah, and you know, I think just basically, obviously, we have an enormous industry engaged in agricultural chemicals. And it's not in the interest of that industry for people to develop a form of agriculture that doesn't require those chemicals. it's possible that much of our current agricultural industry and food processing industry could become obsolete if we move in a direction that's healthy for people and the environment and sustainable. So I think the struggle is quite understandable that those forces that have earned a lot of money from the model that we have wouldn't be so eager to see us move away from it.
What sense did you get from, I don't know how many farmers you talked to in the process of researching this book in Montana, but I mean, did you get the sense that a lot of people use the chemicals because they feel like they have to, they would prefer not to?
Yeah, I think absolutely. you know, in some cases they didn't know an alternative. And there again, you know, it partly comes back to what research did they have access to, what sort of technical support did they have access to. They had a lot of research and support for a chemical recipe. You know, do your soil test. This is how much NPK you need. This is what to apply. They didn't have somebody to come out to their farm and say, you know, maybe this is the cover crop you should plant. Maybe you should think about this crop rotation. So that's why it really required this pooling together of resources and knowledge, because no farmer could take on this transition alone. It's just a massive requirement of new knowledge and a new approach.
Is Montana small enough in population that, for one thing, rigid ideologies don't form as easily because the groups just can't get as big?
Oh, that's a really interesting question.
I think of this in terms of my high school, which was too small to have really well-formed cliques. People had to belong to more than one.
Yes. You know, that's a good point. A million people in Montana, I think, particularly in rural Montana, people maybe have a certain skill for interacting with one another across various forms of difference because there's only so many people in town. And at some point when you're stuck in the mud, you're going to need help from somebody, even if he votes for a political party different from the one you support or goes to a different church.
Mm-hmm.
I think that's probably true in a lot of rural communities.
Mm-hmm.
And I also think, you know, the politics that I think underlay this movement away from corporate agribusiness and towards more local living economies are different from what we see in the party politics at a national scale, that there's sort of a different sense of what the issues are and what's important, and it really does have to do with how much power and money is concentrated in finance and, you know, sort of a corporate structure, and to what extent do we have control over our own destiny in our own communities? You know, how many of the resources stay here and serve our people rather than, you know, just becoming a profit for somebody else? And that's a concern that I think really transcends some of the divides that we might hear about on a national level between, you know, the way politics are structured in our party system.
I notice in the process of the Lentil Underground forming, it seems like some truly strange bedfellows did get together over farm concerns in Montana. And I guess by which I mean, let's hear about Tuna McAlpine. What a great name to begin with.
Yes, yeah. So he had a rancher up in Valier, Montana, who got involved in organics because he's a staunch libertarian. You know, he's concerned that the Republican Party might be getting too soft on guns. He's an NRA member. And his concern about the direction of agriculture was that he didn't want Monsanto or the government telling him what to do. He didn't like this idea of this concentrated power. And so, you know, he starts palling around with David Oyen, who comes out of the anti-war movement in the late 60s and 70s and, you know, is a staunch environmentalist. And, you know, it's pretty interesting, like you said, sort of strange bedfellows that form. You know, also some folks involved in this movement who are really motivated by a deep faith, people who are deeply Christian, homeschool their kids, are part of a movement to, you know, put their faith more at the center of their lives and saw care for creation as, you know, the motivation for them to go organic.
So you got libertarians, you got left wingers, you got Christian fundamentalists, you got pretty much all stripes, it sounds like, involved.
Yes. You know, I think that's a pretty good indication that this is a broad-based idea.
Now, you mentioned that John Tester was a farmer himself before he got elected to the U.S. Senate. How did he figure in this story in his pre-Senate days?
Yeah, and, you know, actually a working farmer still and goes back to Montana on the weekends and sits on the combine. But, you know, he was one of the people who was engaged in the same movement in the 80s. You know, he was looking at the chemical system and saw that it wasn't penciling out well for his family, was concerned about the health impacts, particularly of seed treatment. And so he was one of the early people to go organic, along with David Oyen and a handful of other people in the late 80s. And he will tell you that it was lentils that paid off his house. You know, got a really good crop of lentils in the late 80s, and that was part of what convinced him that this was not only, you know, an ethical system, but also a really viable one. That was how he built his political base. You know, he got to know people through the sustainable agriculture community, was on the Soil Conservation District, and you know, now he's in the U.S. Senate.
He got really well known then around through the organic farming stuff. And I should point out too, he did actually come to Oregon to campaign for Jeff Merkley when he was running for the U.S. Senate first time around.
So sure enough,
we've seen John Tester in the Rogue Valley too. I get the sense that the first couple of years for David Oyen's company, Timeless Seeds, was pretty wobbly at times.
Yes. Yeah. I mean, this is a bunch of farmers with, you know, thoughts about environmental health and public health. Nobody had a business background.
Okay. That doesn't help. But did it seem, I mean, we talked about the fact in the book that lentils were not the first thing, really. A couple of things had been gone through to get to them. Were there times, though, when it looked like lentils weren't going to be the savior either, that they might just have been a stepping stone on the way to something else?
You know, it was slow going at the beginning, and I think, you know, part of that was that they didn't see a lot of people immediately around them eating lentils. So, you know, is there a market for them? They weren't sure, you know, until they tapped into this natural food show in California and started to think, you know, maybe the ticket here is that we sell to natural food stores around the country and we've got a bunch of customers on the West Coast. And, you know, maybe once we prove ourselves, some of our neighbors will be interested in eating this stuff too.
So I noticed that the Trader Joe's actually makes an appearance in here and then doesn't. Can you explain what happened there?
Yeah. So they went to this trade show in California in the early 90s, and this woman comes up to them and she says, you know, I'm a buyer from Trader Joe's. And they thought this was maybe a mom-and-pop grocery store. They hadn't heard of it yet. It was a California chain, about 60 stores at the time. And they were selling lentils. So, you know, they get their first order, and it's this massive order for 400,000 pounds of lentils. That allows them to kind of scale up and get some processing infrastructure going. And they get six farmers planting these lentils. They're really excited about it. They keep delivering these orders from October through June. And then all of a sudden, the orders stop coming. You know, nobody called them and said, oh, we don't want lentils anymore. They just didn't get a call anymore. The trucks stopped coming. And, you know, they called up and found out, oh, it's June. People aren't making as much lentil soup. And so Trader Joe's just canceled. Well, the problem was that lentils are planted in April or May, harvested in August or September. So everybody had already planted their lentils for that year. You know, they had made this investment that they expected to sell to Trader Joe's. So the whole thing had to be reconfigured pretty quickly. And they learned their lesson that diversity isn't just important in your farm fields, it's also important in your markets. And, you know, you don't want to be beholden to one customer any more than you want to be beholden to one corporation to whom you supply a commodity.
And a lot is said in agriculture these days about particularly family businesses being vertically integrated. So they'll not only be producing, but they'll also be selling an end product. Is it that well developed then for the guys of the lentil underground, or are they still pretty much handing it off to other people or looking for other buyers in bulk?
No, that's right. It's pretty much vertically integrated. There are a few folks who actually sell at the farmer's market and do CSA. The rest of it is they have a branded retail package as well as, you know, selling in bulk bins, and they work with a network of natural food stores around the country. They also sell direct to schools, to colleges, to hospitals. And those are pretty exciting partnerships because they're able to get these large, stable orders, provide these healthy foods at a lower price to people who really can benefit from them.
Do they think they've hit a ceiling? I mean, is there a saturation point for lentils that has been reached, or can they keep pushing, expanding markets, developing new products using lentils, and just keep getting more people consuming them?
You know, the challenge is actually for Timeless Natural Food right now, this business that these farmers formed, is production capacity. They now have more markets than they can currently supply, and it's a process, it's a long process for a farmer to transition from a chemically based grain system to, you know, rotating in these lentils. So they're very active sort of with their own extension network, if you will, getting other farmers, you know, to the point where they can participate in these markets that are continuing to grow.
It must be a mixed blessing, though, in a sense, because I get the feeling, perhaps, that if you end up having too many lentils, you end up in the same area that a lot of farmers end up in, where they can't get much for their corn, for their wheat, for their soy, for whatever. So, I mean, any concerns about that? And Let me just leave it at that point, though, the economic part of it.
I think we have a long way to go before lentils are that popular of a commodity. You know, there is some question about what might replace soy as, you know, sort of a vegetarian protein for things like veggie burgers. That could be a vehicle for lentils to become a larger commodity than they are. It sounds like probably pea protein is more likely on that front. But we just have so much more room to grow in our consumption and production of lentils when you look at other places around the world, you know, kind of with the 10,000-year perspective and the global perspective, India, the Middle East, South America, Africa. We just don't eat a lot of plant-based proteins in this country, and there's a consequence not only in our diets and for our health, but also for the landscape, because those proteins really have a role in farm rotation. So we have quite a lot of ground to make up before we would get too concerned about having too much.
You talked a fair amount about farm policy, and obviously the federal government, through the various farm bills, can make or break a lot of lines of products. So is federal legislation at least holding lentils harmless, or is it assisting it in some way?
You know, things have gotten a lot better. You couldn't insure your lentil crop in the late 80s when these farmers started, so that was a huge deterrent. They were having to give up not only those direct commodity payments that they would get for things like wheat and barley, but also any insurance against a hail damage or a drought or those types of things. Starting in 2004, you now can insure lentils, and the Farm Bill now provides for something called whole farm insurance, which allows a farmer to insure the value of his or her farm, whatever the crops are. So the federal government is no longer saying, you know, the only winners here are wheat, corn, soy, the big commodities. So that's provided quite a lot more flexibility and, you know, risk management for these organic farmers.
It's really a fascinating case study as we learn about these farmers in western Montana. Liz Carlisle's book is called Lentil Underground, Renegade Farmers and the Future of Food in America. Liz, thanks so much for writing it and for joining us on The Exchange.
Thanks so much, Jeffrey.
All right, take care.